I spread a song so you can sing along with my special guest star
two.
You like to sing and dance, and this podcast by chance explores musicals for you. Theme Song, yeah!
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Life's But a Song, a podcast that likes to live in the land of musicals. I'm your host John, and with me today are two very special returning guests. They haven't been on in a while, and we're going to fix that. It's Sam Smith and Matan Shahar, everyone. Woo!
Yay! Hey.
Y'all sound so thrilled. Yay!
It's just living in Arizona. Breaks you down.
We're conserving our energy. We got to make it through the summer here.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Yeah. Yeah, and I know... Welcome to Weather Talk, everyone. I know here in New York, it's just been all over the place weather-wise. So I'm assuming it's just been boiling hot where you are.
It's the oven is preheating right now.
Yeah, yeah. We haven't reached peak heat.
Yeah, it's not. But once it's up there, then we're dead. So, but we're excited to be on the show again.
Yes, because
a great movie,
one of the best movies, I would say. Me personally, one of the best movies.
Because we're here today to talk about The Producers from 2005. Not the original one, because the original one is not technically a musical, but they did it. The screenplay is by the one and only Mel Brooks and Thomas Meehan. Music and lyrics by Mel Brooks. Directed by Susan Stroman. And according to IMDb, after putting together another Broadway flop, down on his luck producer Max Bialystock teams up with timid accountant Leo Bloom in a get rich quick scheme to put on the world's worst show. So before we get started, like talking about the movie, have y'all seen the show? Like the stage version of it?
Sadly, no.
Yeah, I've not seen the stage. Seen the original film.
Yeah, same.
But yeah, I've seen that once, and then I've seen this once. I guess it was high school.
It would have been high school when it came out. Middle school.
Or eighth grade, maybe, yeah. I think. And
I've seen them both countless times.
So I think this was my second viewing ever, which plays into a lot of things, because I had some interesting opinions about this movie. we'll get to it.
Well, so I was wondering if you picked this because the few movies we've done together have a common theme among them. Oh, you're pointing to Sam. Sam picked this one, I'm assuming.
It's always me.
Yeah, he's the one that picked it, and this is a movie that he'll reference it as much as he possibly
all the time. It's part of my DNA.
Yeah.
Okay, so Matan, I'm assuming you didn't like this with the way that your body language and what you're talking about.
So... I'm a master of deception. No, I actually loved this movie.
He just hates that I love it.
No, but I do love ruining your day. But the movie was great. It starts off super strong for me. And then about halfway through, it kind of starts to drop off.
Yeah, that's understandable. Because it felt like a three-act structure where it was like the first act was them hatching the plan and getting pieces together. Then the second act was like, you know, now we're at the audition and it's the end of springtime for Hitler. And then the third act is the fallout. And I feel like you're talking about like the fallout portion of it where like they get caught and they go to jail and all that feels like, it feels a little slower in a very different story, if I'm being totally honest.
Yeah, there's a bit of a lag in the movie.
Yeah, so, but the first part, there's so much to talk about. So, obviously we have Matthew Broderick as Leo Bloom.
Yes.
Probably most famous for killing those two women in Ireland in 1987 by driving on the wrong side of the road.
That's what he's most famous for.
Exactly, that and Godzilla. And then
in this little movie called The Lion King. Tiny movie.
And this super indie film called Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, nobody's ever seen that one.
Sure.
Or the criminally underrated Tower Heist.
Oh, shut up. Okay, so A, he references Tower Heist as much as possible. He personally invested money into that film, and he needs to get his investment back by trying to get everybody to see that movie.
One
and
of the greatest movie in cast of all time.
Did. No, it's not. It's nobody a terrible movie. You. Nobody listened History to Sam.
Forgot it. You are the only person keeping it alive.
It's and I will fan the flame, whatever they say.
And so, but yeah, you're fanning the flame of the arson that everyone else started to burn that movie down.
All right, here's my thing though. Is for the listeners who might not know some of his greater work, I'm going for the most popular one. Like, I can't say Tower Heist, obviously. I can't say Torch Song Trilogy. What other ones?
You would go for Ferris Bueller, though, and this.
Ferris Bueller.
He won't bring that. Action. He won't say the actual most popular. He'll say his favorite.
He will.
And they are obscure. But again, he will also, you're also famous for this.
Guys, it sounds like you two need to work this out off camera.
Yeah, let's move
recording.
On.
So Matthew Broderick reprises his role as Leo Bloom because he was in the original stage production, as well as Nathan Lane, Gary Beach, and Roger Bart. They were all in it. And then the film also includes a smattering of other actors that were in the show as well.
As cameos, as extras.
One of them is actually in this episode as a special guest that I will edit in later. Ooh. I'm here now with Brad Oscar, who originated the role of Franz Liebkind on the Broadway. Hi, Brad.
Good morning. Hello there.
So what was it like? Like, were you part of the original, like, workshops and everything for this?
Well, no, my story is actually quite strange and unique as far as the producers go, because I was literally cast at the last minute, like 2 weeks before they started rehearsal. I was cast to cover the role of Max. They were just looking for a cover for that role that Nathan Lane, of course, was playing. So I went in. It all happened very quickly. They also had me read Franz at the audition, I guess, just to see and get a sense of what that would be. And then literally, as I said, 2 weeks later, I think it was, I started rehearsal. And by the time I walked into the rehearsal room for the first day, I was really a swing, in the sense that not only was I covering Max and Franz and Roger Debris, but I was covering all of the character men in the ensemble. So it was crazy. And I was a little overwhelmed at the amount of material, obviously, that I was going to have to be responsible for. But we got to Chicago pre-Broadway, and the actor playing Franz went down with a knee issue during final rehearsals. As the primary understudy, I was in as Franz then for those last couple rehearsals and most of our Chicago run. So wow. Yeah, because he didn't come back till the end. And then it was just one of those cases, you know, we're in a purely subjective business, as we know, and they decided they were happy with what I was doing, and they let the other actor go. And then I was, at that point, when we got back to New York from Chicago, before we opened officially on Broadway, I was Franz Liebkind, and I was still covering Max Bialystock. So that's how that all sort of came to be. I was not involved with prior to the rehearsals for Broadway. And the whole thing was just a wild, wacky sequence of events. The next thing I knew, I was playing Franz. We opened. It became what it became. I got a Tony nomination. It was a big deal. Yeah, I mean, it was a wild. I mean, again, it was just like fantasy land. It was crazy. I couldn't believe how it was all playing out. And and then I played Franz for the first year, and then I took over Max eventually and played Max on Broadway for several years, on and off. Opened the second national tour. Went to London.
Yeah, I was seeing that. But yeah. You played him in the West End as well. How was How is it over there?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, you know, I always dreamt of Broadway, right? And of doing this. But to work over there was wonderful. It was an amazing experience, just culturally. You know, first of all, culturally, obviously the theater over there has a very rich and deep cultural history.
Yes.
You know, it's so much more a part of, I believe, their culture than it is ours. And certainly as far as government funding and stuff like that goes, the arts are, you know, a little more supported over there. So it's wonderful to be in a community where theater is taken so seriously. Ironically, musical theater over there is not looked at as being as, you know, but little by little, obviously, they've come around. And of course, my God, there's a ton of, you know, musicals that they've given us as well. But it was, you know, it was a joy working over there. The history, I was treated very well. I played opposite a great English actor, comedian named Lee Evans, who was just a wonderful Leo, marvelous, beloved over there. So that was also fun. It was the gift that kept on giving, you know, producers for me, unquestionably, for like 7 years. And then eventually after it had closed on Broadway, they gave Vegas a try. There was that window in the mid 2000s when a lot of Broadway shows were suddenly thinking, yes, Vegas was going to be a popular place to see a Broadway show, even in and unfortunately in a cut down form, because you know they often do these 90-minute versions of shows out there. Cab versions. Oh yeah, this is a long history of this. The 50s and the 60s. Once Vegas became a very popular destination, they would do 90-minute versions of, you know, Hello Dolly and Mame and all these shows on the Strip. And that way you were in and out. There was no intermission. You got back to the gambling tables or the buffet or whatever. So indeed, we did a 90-minute version of The Producers at the Paris Hotel. But again, this was that window of time when all these producers were realizing that, well, no, Vegas doesn't necessarily embrace Broadway musicals in that sense. In a broader sense, certain shows did very well out there because they're glorified concerts, whether we're talking about Jersey Boys or something like Mamma Mia, the jukebox thing, you know, which is its own thing. And so, but I got to do, you know, 6 months of The Producers in Vegas, a 90-minute version, which was a hell of a lot easier on me as far as that goes. And just another, you know, random good time.
So how many years were you with The Producers, the entity?
Well, I mean, on and off, like we opened in 2001, in the spring of 2001, and pretty much through 2005, I was actively doing The Producers, whether it was here on Broadway or that second national tour that I opened. And then I came back and then I went away for a little bit to do some other stuff and then Vegas in 2007. So...
Wow.
Yeah, I mean it was an amazing, you know, wonderful thing. I still cherish the whole experience and the people that I got to work with, and you know, and again, at the end of the day, as far as being an actor and having material to go out there and play that just elevates everyone around you, and it was such a joy because the material is so fantastic. You know, you don't have to work to make a show like that work. You just do it and give it its all, and it's there for you.
So you got to hang out with Mel Brooks then too.
I did. This. Yeah, sure.
Is he lovely in person as I feel like he is?
I mean, he is Mel Brooks. I mean, he is, because he's been, I guess, in our public consciousness, right? And with us creating these, you know, absolutely ridiculous, amazing, whether it's the film or the stage stuff. But and he is exactly in many ways who you think he would be. That's his you know, that persona that comes through in so much of his work, and because he also appears in a lot of his work, you know, so Mel himself, yes, presence that we know, it's not like he's just a writer. My God, he is a personality and an actor as well. So yes, it was, just again, to be in the presence of that, to collaborate, if you will, with those people, Mel and Susan Stroman and, you know, Thomas Meehan, who helped Mel with the book, you know, and all of our design. I mean, these were all people working at the top of their craft and all coming together, you know, and that's what I always say too about musicals, the randomness of getting everyone on the same page, you know, at once.
Yes.
So that it really just, it is a whole, and it's not just, oh, well, the score was great, but the booked wasn't, oh, the design looked wonderful, but this, you know,
right.
When shows, when it all comes together, when something happens like a Hamilton, like a Producers, like a whatever, all the great, you know, the great ones, they are great shows. They are shows that, that resonate and stay with us and become cultural touchstones because they do it the best. They do it like, man, like it should ideally come together. And that's a very random, subjective, yeah, thing, as we know.
So when the movie came around, when they were starting to do
yes.
that.
Yes, yes, movie, yes.
Yes, because that's where we're talking about the movie. Did they give you a call to come in to do something? Did they audition you for something?
No, no. Here's my recollection. My recollection is that as the movie started to come together, I was, gosh, I'm trying, you know, it's so funny, history. I think I was aware that I was not going to play Franz, that they were looking for, you know, obviously, I mean, look, this is not something that's new to us as Broadway performers. You know, we're not stars. We're not movie stars. They're going to make a movie and they're going to want to put big names and movie stars in that movie. I get it. That's part of our business.
It's,
and we can
it's
point
show to business.
Exactly. And look yeah. at all the movie musicals that have been made where we're like, oh, she was great, but wouldn't it have been nice to see Ethel Merman do Gypsy? Or, oh, you know, don't even get me started on the film of Mame. Oi. But anyway, my point is, it happens. So I was aware of that. Now, I, at the same time, I am in London because I have been sent to London because Nathan Lane opens the London production, but is in very bad physical shape. Poor guy. They begged him to go over there. They had cast Richard Dreyfuss, and that's an entirely other story for an entirely other podcast, but boy, it makes a good one. So so they're begging that Nathan comes over. He opens the show in the West End with opposite Lee Evans. God bless him. He, you know, he's there for them in that respect. But he did not stay very long because he was in a lot of pain and discomfort. So so yeah, they said, Will you go over and take over the role of Max in the West End? And I was like, oh my God. So anyway, my point is I'm over there while they are starting production on the film. So that complicated matters. Plus, you know, what was, again, there was a lot of ensemble stuff. So they were going to put me in here or there. But I think because I was doing the West End, and getting me back here was going to be a bit of an issue, or at least a timing thing. Yeah, I turn up in the movie very briefly as a cab driver during the We Can Do It section at the beginning that ends in Central Park. I take them from the office to Central Park, and you get a very brief glimpse of me, and you know, and literally that's it, and it is what it is. And you know, again, the whole experience, just being involved with the show, it's not something that I, you know, feel any bitterness to. I really don't. It is what it is. Would it have been fun to play Franz? Of course it would have been. And was it a little more what's the word I want, you know, because Roger Bart and Gary Beach got to recreate their roles. Thank God. Brilliant performance. I mean, Gary's Tony winning performance is on film for us to always have. Roger Bart as Carmen Ghia is there for the ages. I mean, much less Matthew and Nathan. And that's what I think also is special about the film. I know the film was not well received. I know, I don't know what people thought it was going to be or what it was supposed to do, but it is there as a pretty damn good documentation of what the stage show was, you know, put on film. And I know it's very stage bound still on screen a little bit, but it's just the nature of the piece in a way. And I think a lot of the critical response to the film, I think we might think differently in 10, 20 years. Well, it's been 10, my gosh,
it's been a while.
but I know whenever I pass by it on TV or if I see it, I'm just thrilled that it's there again, that it's there and that it looks and sounds very much like the original Broadway production did, because that's all we've got, right? We have no video of the original production unless you go to the Lincoln Center Library.
Right.
You know, there's no public, there's no, like they recorded.
There was no pro shot or something.
No. I mean, and it again, that just doesn't happen very often. It happens occasionally. And thank God, like, we have some of those Sondheims, you know, we have Into the Woods and Sunday in the Park and Passion mm-hmm. were recorded, you know, with their original Broadway companies. That's amazing. Waitress, of course, recently, but 9 times out of 10, it doesn't happen. So yeah, I'm grateful to be a part of it. I did get a lovely note from Will Ferrell. I'll never forget, because I was in my dressing room in London, and you know, a very nice note that just said, you know, I hope to do it justice, and whatever. It was very sweet. It was very kind, and I actually thought he was fine. He was very funny. I mean, he's a very funny guy. God knows,
right? And you both attacked the character in different ways. It feels like.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, obviously you attacked it differently because you're on stage. So every night it's a different performance.
Sure.
But you said that you were originally an understudy for Roger Dubree as well. Did you ever go on?
I never did. My recollection is that I had one real understudy rehearsal that first year. Because after we opened, I was Franz covering Max. Nathan started to miss some performances because, again, nobody should do this role 8 times a week. It's exhausting vocally. And I'm just talking about the shouting, the dialogue, not so much even the singing, just vocally. And Nathan doesn't give less than 100%. He's, you know, he's a remarkable stage creature, if you will. So anyway, it started to catch up with him a little bit, as it would anyone. Again, our bodies are not meant to do this. Nobody, as I always say, nobody else does this. Ballet dancers, opera singers, sports figures, you know, no one does 8 of them a week. But guess what? We do. And we're expected to do it like it's just part of the deal. And yes, it is part of the deal. But my God, the body is the body. So,
and if memory serves, Max is a character that like barely leaves stage.
Oh, yeah. For Act 1, you barely leave the stage in Act 1. It is so, a marathon.
So it's exhausting. But from an audience perspective, watching it, you're like, oh my God, it's whoever playing Max Bialystock, and they're so funny and they're great and talented.
Yeah. And believe me, you ride the wave. I mean, when you have, you know, and audiences were usually great because, again, the show delivered. So you ride that wave. And that is, I always say, it's an exchange of energy with the audience. And that definitely invigorates and energizes, you know, the actor as far as that goes. But yeah, it was a lot. So because I was Franz covering Max, and for a period of time, I was doing the Wednesday and Saturday matinees as Max, and then the night performance as Franz, so that Nathan didn't have to do 2 in a day. So I think we were very aware that the odds of me going on for Roger Dubree were probably fairly small, and that the other actor covering it would most likely go and did. But anyway, I did have one rehearsal. I did have one time to wear the Chrysler Building gown. Not sure if it was, I can't imagine they built one for me, but I did get to at least give it a whirl. So much fun. I mean, what a great role. What a great role. And, but I never went on for the role, you know, on stage. Yeah.
So do you have a fun story of like something happening during a performance? I mean, I know you probably have a million stories, but like what's like your go-to cocktail party story about?
It's so funny because, you know, I did it so many. I mean, I counted that I played Max well over 1200 times.
Wow.
So between Broadway and the tour and Vegas and London, you know. So honestly, what's funny is now looking back, you know, it's like so many different places, people, thing, you know. So yeah, when you ask me that, it's so funny. Nothing immediately comes to mind because my God, it's just years of, you know, experience.
Right. Experience, wow. Says
it, if you will. Look, honestly, I'll never forget the first times having to go on for Max. You know, literally months after the show opened, was the biggest thing to hit Broadway in years. People are coming to see, you know, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick star in a Broadway musical. They would get to the theater and they would see the sign that said, you know, Nathan is out and the role will be performed by Brad Oscar. And I'm sure 99% of the people said, who the hell is Brad Oscar? And went in begrudgingly because you couldn't get tickets. So if you had gotten a ticket, you were at least going to see Matthew that night. but you probably weren't going to be able to exchange that ticket for another performance within the year that the boys were, you know, signed for. So anyway, plus
you gamble that because the ticket you get again, you never know.
Exactly. Of course. Right. And most people did stay, I feel. But anyway, it would just be a very, a wonderful feeling. And, you know, the more I got to do it and settle in and the stronger I got. But, you know, by the end of the evening and, you know, you do that big number in the jail cell, Betrayed, at the end of Act Two there, that 11 o'clock number for Max. You know, again, when all things are firing, everything's full steam ahead and the audience is there. And by that point in the show, I think they were like, hey, this guy did pretty good. He was fine. Sure, we miss Nathan, but hey, he acquitted himself well. And so by the end of Betrayed, as they would with Nathan, of course, my God, they would, you know, they would go crazy. The response was just so satisfying in that way that you're like, wow, they like me. They really like me, you know, in that way, because it felt, because again, I've been there. I've walked into a theater and looked up at the board and see, you know, your star is out or someone you came to see or really wanted to see is not on the show. And you're like, oh man, you know, and we know understudies are town. We know all those wonderful things. It's not about, it's nothing disparaging about the understudy or the standby. It's just that you want to see the guy. So I get that.
Right.
But it was very satisfying to make those people happy and hopefully make those people feel like they got their experience, they got their producer's experience and they got their money's worth or whatever it was. And so, yeah, I'll never forget that because it's, you know, it's a nice feeling. Let's face it. What we do, you know, as I said, is purely subjective and what it's all we use what we got, right? Our voice, our body, our choices, our passion, all that stuff. So it's a very personal thing. Ego in the pure sense. I am what I do, you know, ego in that sense, not in like, look at me, but a sense of self in that way. And so yes, sure. When you get love like that, when you feel that from an audience, it's very gratifying, satisfying. And you know, that's sort of pat on the back in a way. So, yeah.
So if they were to call you up and say, hey, we're doing another production of The Producers. So who would you want to play and why is it Ula?
Wow, you took my joke. That's not fair. How dare you? How dare you?
No, but seriously, if you were called up, wow, and they were like, we're doing another Producers, you get to be Max again.
Right.
Would you?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would get my ass to the gym right away, of course, because talk about a workout. So yeah, I would need to be physically prepared to do it.
But you mean more like stamina for the role, exactly, like you were talking about, not like getting in quote shape for it. It's like, no, I have to run around the stage.
Please, Zira Mostel, hardly hardly a, you know, the physical specimen. But yes, on stage, yes, it's a little more as far as that goes. But no, I think I would love to do it again. And I think it would be tough for me to do any role but Max now, in a way, just because for so long I was in that position. You know, you're really, you know, you're driving the bus, you're, you know, you're the leader in that respect. And I appreciate that. And I love that responsibility in many ways. And so, yeah, at some point I would love to, but I don't know how much longer we've got in that tank. So we'll see. So it might be Franz again, or maybe, I don't know, Roger Dubree.
I would love to see you in the Chrysler dress as Roger, because it would be, I think they missed out on having you be in Keep It Gay in the movie. Just as one of the boys or something.
Yeah. A great number, and literally when I was doing the show, one of my favorite scenes to play, because at that point in the course of the play, finally you're meeting the other character, you know, it's very Wizard of Oz, right? We go, we meet the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Lion, right? So we go and we meet Franz, Roger Dubree, Carmen Gia, and then Ula. So what's lovely at that point in the show for Max and Leo, especially for Max, is that other people drive the scene a little bit and you can sort of breathe for a second, because you've just spent the first 45 minutes pretty much nonstop, you know. So yes, I used to and I just think that scene is, you could teach it in a musical theater class. the introduction of those two characters, Carmen Gia and Roger Dubree, the actual plot, what's actually happening to get us from A to B, and then a song that I just think is, you know, hilarious and charming and builds to a fabulous climax. And I loved doing that number every night. And especially with many different Roger Dubrees over the course of my experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I had so many Leo. Oh my God, I think I played opposite 17 different guys as Leo. Holy, you know, between shit, 8 times a week and understudies and swings and whatever over the course of, you know, again, a long experience. But so that was another great thing, because again, Roger is such a delicious role, and so many fabulous musical theater actors, or even just act, not even musical theater actors, really just made a meal of it. And yeah, I love that scene.
Well, Brett, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything you would like to plug or promote? Anything?
Well, no. I mean, come see Wicked again if you haven't seen it in a while.
Oh, yes. You're in Wicked.
I'm the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Please. And again, you know, you talk about, you know, shows that fire on all cylinders and are, and my God, could that become more of a, you know, and hey, aren't we excited about the movie? Which looks wonderful. I mean, I'm so excited. It looks really beautiful.
Yes, that trailer made me want to buy a ticket right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. And, you know, and hopefully they're not going to shy away from the fact that it's a musical. You know, I love these movies that come out, like that Mean Girls movie that was out recently of the musical. You would never know it was a musical. They did everything to, you know, again, not, it's not, no, because somehow they think that turns people off. But I think everybody knows what Wicked is and the brand. Yes.
So. I would hope so by now. Everyone knows. I
hope so. Yeah. But I'm excited. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Brad. And
thanks, John. This was great. Thank you.
Let's get back to the movie. It's been a while since I've seen this movie, but I remember seeing it in theaters and then watching it again. And I have to say, though, for being like a Mel Brooks film, and we know Mel Brooks's comedy is a little like toting the line, I feel like this one is pretty like it's going to stand the test of time, because it, yes, they're making fun of theater and gays and everything, but like, honestly, as a queer person, like I was like, the treatment of Carmen Gia and Roger Dubree are like pretty spot on for being stereotypes. Like, I know people like that, let's put it that way. But like, how did you feel about the comedy of this movie,
Tim? As a kid, I loved it. I will say, each year it goes by when I rewatch it, because I probably say it once a year, I'm always in my head, I'm always like, is this problematic or is this okay? And I'm always, because I mean, I'm not a queer person, so then I don't know. But then I'm always like, well, I feel like Mel Brooks isn't someone who did it like maliciously. Like, his place is always from a place of humor. But yeah, it is a question I always ask myself now. It seems like as the years go by, I'm like, is there any problematic parts with this musical?
Like, I think they would have, like, if you given the chance, like if you ask him about it, maybe he'd be like, oh, like I would have changed some things here and there kind of thing. Like, I think he's like, but at the time, like, people were still saying the R word and the other F word, and you know what I mean? Like, right. So yeah. This is definitely like tamer for sure. Mm-hmm. Not that he was like a big, like he wasn't like South Park level, you know what I mean? But he's like for the comedy, for the, yeah, the joke, for he's the always movie.
Push the envelope, Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
I mean, even the original producers, a lot of Jewish people were mad about making fun of Hitler 20 years after the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Needed some time.
Yeah, but like now, and like now though, I feel like it's been far enough, but like they made it uber farcical because of having Roger be like overly feminine and playing Hitler and everything, and the joke about Hitler being a long line of queens and everything like that. I honestly feel like, though, that like in 20 years I feel like this film will still be considered hilarious. Like, I know I was laughing, but like I've also like I said, I've seen the show and I've seen the movie many times before. So,
well, I think in 20 years you'll be seeing a new version of it, because again, just they recycle everything.
Yeah, but Mel Brooks will probably still be here. He'll be 120.
Exactly. But just like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, people are going to have they'll reboot it. They'll do this, do that. But this will always be a version that people like, oh, this is my favorite. Or, you know, like this one holds up. And this, like, I feel like will stick with a lot of people and stuff. Because people, like, there's the original movie and stuff, and that's great, but again, not musical necessarily, but like, hold, people are like that, you know, the original is the best and whatnot. But then when you do a third reboot, unless it's Spider-Man, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not, right. I don't have high hopes, but it's a fun movie to see, like, especially.
Or the seventh version of Annie.
Yeah, right. But like the combination of whoever is going to be Leo and whoever is going to be Max, like, it's because, like, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick in this, I feel like Nathan Lane is a big, like, actor, you know what I mean? Like, he's very, like,
bombastic, over the top.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But this was, like, upped the ante.
This is the most, like, iconic performance, I think.
Yeah. And
this is the one he'll be remembered for.
Yes. And, like, there were some bits that just were so funny, and just like the timing, and just like the script too, like, was so weird, and like there were parts that were just like bonkers for bonkers' sake, but like that's what made it so fun and chaotic. And then Matthew Broderick, we have to talk about his autism, because
I'm glad you brought it up, because
he's just so blank.
He just felt like a cartoon character with those triggers.
Yeah.
But right. Is that the right word I want to use? Like, when he's
dealing with the
blanket and his reaction to things, especially
auditory overload and sensory stuff.
Just the way he talks.
But
that's been his acting style, though, for, like, I don't know, 30 years now. It's weird. I don't know what changed him.
But this was another...
I mean, it was probably the car accident.
The show ruined him.
Like, yeah, 80s Broderick and, like, 90s, 2000s Broderick are, like, two different people.
Yeah.
Well, so they did it in 2001, like I said. The movie came out 4 years later. So, and you figure they probably did it on Broadway together for about a year. Maybe a little longer. And like Matan was saying, like, you can see there's some bits that they have that they do in the show, especially like the oath when they start flipping it off and everything, and they switch fingers.
So good.
Like that is something that I even noted. I was like, you can tell they did this for 8 times a week for about a year. Like, you know, there's little things like that, and their banter with each other, because they were practicing for however long they did it on Broadway. Like, it was so well done. But also Matthew Broderick, I just wanted to hit him a bunch of times, especially when he started, like, caressing the blanket and everything.
I have an opinion on his performance, and Sam is going to have an opinion on my opinion.
Oh no.
So Matthew Broderick in this was essentially what Martin Short tried to do in Clifford. I don't know if you've seen the movie Clifford. Please,
I have
don't.
Not seen
don't,
it.
Please don't do. Let anybody please else do. See it.
It'll change your life.
For the worse.
For the better.
And so this felt like that, but like he got it. But at the same time, because it's Matthew Broderick, and like I'm just used to him being like quiet and mild-mannered, tepid a little bit, but like he is obnoxious in this, but like he starts off like obviously, you know, like timid and then shy and weird, and then, you know, with his panic attacks and all that stuff, but then like to see him, for lack of a better term, bloom into himself.
I see what you did there.
You saw
face. So disappointed.
You were proud of that.
I was proud of that, but still,
bravo.
He like
bravo.
Thank you. To see him at the end of the movie and he's singing, he's dancing once he gets laid, essentially, that solves all of his like tics, I guess. Like, and he's like a functioning member of society now.
Yeah, because you would think being in prison would cause him to have more triggers or to
stress, but no.
Well, he's just a prisoner of love, so you know, it helped him.
Ugh.
He bloomed.
No, doesn't work when you do it. Doesn't work when you do it.
No, you're it's too soon for a callback, Sam.
Fun fact though about Martin Short.
Oh no.
So he did the producers in LA as Bloom with Jason Alexander, but Mel Brooks originally wanted him to do Bloom on Broadway, but he turned it down because of kids, and then they got Matthew Broderick.
Jason Alexander and Martin Short together, like, that's a good pairing. That's like a perfect like stunt casting pairing, I feel like.
I agree. I think that must have been a great show too.
So we get to new cast members with this. We have Will Ferrell playing Franz, mm-hmm. which made sense because on SNL he sang a couple of times, and the character is more comedic than a singer, I feel like, anyway.
Yeah.
But
and they needed a big draw.
They needed a big draw, yes. But then we get to Uma Thurman. And this is a point of contention I know I have with a lot of theater people because they have conflicting thoughts about casting her. How do you two feel, though, about her?
I'll be honest, I think she's the weak link.
I was completely indifferent to her. I did not realize it was Uma Thurman until right now when you guys said it was Uma Thurman.
She's like 7 feet tall. Come on.
It has been a minute since I have seen Uma Thurman. And then this is not typically how I see Uma Thurman.
Because she does a lot more serious work.
Yeah.
Not over the top comedy like this.
Yeah. And I like she did it and it like got the job done. But like, yeah, I mean, I don't know who it could have been that would have been. That, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people that would be better, but like,
because it feels like they were with Max, Leo, Ula, and Franz. They were going for like names. They needed like a draw. Like in concept, I understand it, but I also feel like she did a fine job with the song. Like she did the job. To me, it doesn't sound bad. It doesn't. It sounds good, you know. It sounds like, okay, you did it, thank you for showing up and having she's and you can tell she's having the best time, like she is having she's fun cool. But again, but like I agree with you, Matan, I don't know who else would have done it.
Charlize Theron, I think that just came, but she can be funny.
Yeah,
true. Yes,
I have no idea about her singing at all, but like,
yes,
it's just because when you're like stunt cast, like whatever, or trying to get names or whatever.
Amy Poehler, if she could, I don't know if she can sing.
But that's the thing is, like, Will Ferrell, like, can sing, yeah, kind of, but at the same time, like, but it's not, that's not the point. It's because it's, he makes it even more ridiculous and goofy. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought should have been from her. And it was just kind of plain. But then, like, I don't know, Matthew Broderick's characters playing.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, they're a perfect match.
I mean, she's not bad. She's fine. But if you compare all the performances, she just falls underneath the weak link.
Well, oh my God, song is my favorite of the movie.
Yeah, and same.
Like, yeah, that, again, this is where...
Her song's like where I go to, like, to pee or
this
to get
is where
snack.
This is where it starts slipping.
Oh, really? Movie. See, I like the one that I would skip is That Face. Like it's an okay song. Yeah. I'm just like, I'd rather not.
Agreed. After Max's prison song, I forget the title, but after that, it starts to go kind of down for a while until like you get like Prisoners of Love. I feel like,
yeah.
Oh, Betrayal.
Betrayal. Yeah.
Betrayed. Yes, that is something that I remember that they plucked right out of the stage version and put into the film. Down to the recreated choreography, because I was watching it. I don't really remember the show itself, but there are pockets of things that I do remember, like the hireling pigeons. And I remember that in Betrayed, he does that whole manic choreography while recapping everything we've seen.
Yeah. So, no,
sorry, there's some sentences that even catch me by surprise, like saying hireling pigeons.
Yeah, no, that it, oh, yeah. It was goofy.
The lyrics are just so out there.
Absolutely. Oh, God, yes.
It's funny because, like, this, I think this show, this movie, everything, each time it comes out feels like it's ahead of its time.
Yes.
Because in 2005, like, this feels modern. Like, this feels like it came out recently just because it just, it's just a great bit.
Yeah.
And just like, but no, it's like it's all from all the way, you know,
yeah, 2005.
These songs are songs you can't like listen in the car with the windows down because they're just so out there.
I mean, I do, so whatever. But I'm me, so that
yeah, sure. I'm too much of a chicken. I'm over here just humming to myself. Don't be stupid. Be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Yeah.
Just humming it to myself. That's the lyric that gets stuck in my head all the time.
Yeah.
I'll just be at like Target. Next thing you know, I'm just humming along to this.
Yeah.
And like the other like litany of cameos in this, like we have Andrea Martin playing one of the old ladies. John Barrowman is the soloist in Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah.
Like Michael McKean is a prisoner at the very end, like very literally end. Just walking on.
Richard Kind's the juror.
Yeah,
the
juror that threw me off.
He played Bialystok.
Yes,
on Broadway.
Yeah, he was one of the replacements. This movie had it all except for Mel Brooks. Like, I don't think I don't remember seeing Mel Brooks in it. I know
he does like a voice.
No, he does voices for like 1 second in. Oh, which number was it? It's near the end. He's in like a top hat and a tux. Like it cuts to him like
for a millisecond or something.
Yeah,
I don't.
Was it like when they did Prisoners of Love on Broadway?
I think so. Sam, see if you can look it up. But I think he was, unless I hallucinated it.
I mean,
he like springs out of a group of people to like finish the line of the song or something, and it's him. And I was like, oh, there he is.
Well, because the line that Sam mentioned is him. It's his voice.
Yeah.
And that was even from the stage version. This is one of the movies that I feel like the transfer from stage to screen worked.
Sam confirmed he's the voice of the pigeon, Isle the pigeon, and then the cat. But then you were just on IMDb, and now you're re-Googling the movie?
I was going to Google it to see if I could find it faster than scrolling through trivia.
Yeah, because there's a shit ton of trivia in this.
Okay.
Yeah, end of the movie, Mel Brooks tells the audience, oh, that was the end credits.
Okay.
Which, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. But no, I think because they bring him back because he's also in the tux in the credits.
I'll believe you.
Yeah, he's in the movie but for 2 seconds, but then he's in at the end credits. Did you watch the end credits of this movie?
I didn't go to the very, very, very end. Which is what you're talking about, because I see it on the spoiler section of the IMDb trivia that he tells the audience it's over and time to go home.
Yeah, it's a Ferris Bueller like homage, essentially, but like they do it in song and dance and stuff like that. And I was like, well, this was delightful. Like, you know,
is it safe to say you guys also haven't seen the DVD special features of the cutscenes from the movie?
Correct.
It's been a minute.
Because they have like a lot of songs. Like they filmed the King of Broadway one, but they didn't put it in the movie. And then there's a scene at the bar that has Ernie, I forget his last name, but he voiced Pumbaa in The Lion King. So you get Timon, Simba, and Pumbaa in the producers for a deleted scene. Nice. It's all they're all connected. It's like the circle of life or something.
Oh, shut up. Okay. Let's move on.
Well, so the whole conceit of this is like them wanting to find a bad show so that they can have a flop. But I don't know how well you guys follow Broadway trends or anything like that, but like no one really seeks out a flop. Like to be a flop. Like it is show business. It's a business. They want to make profits off of it. It just so happens that shows close earlier than they intended because of lack of ticket sales, or another global event happens that causes Broadway to shut down.
That's part of the reason they do so many revivals, I think, right? Is because it's always safer.
Not really. No, because then there's some revival, like the Chicago revival is the only one that's like lasted as long as it has. I mean, for good reason, too, because it's cheap to put on and you can stunt cast that all the time. But
they did a good job of the stunt casting.
Yes, they have with that
Every couple years, I'll be like, David Hasselhoff is going to Broadway? This is weird, but okay. I guess this works.
It's such an interesting concept when you think about it, because realistically, like, I don't think people are wanting a flop to happen, or I don't, it doesn't feel like this is real. Like, you make more money when you have a flop. But Max's rule about not putting your own money into the show seems like it's a real thing. So it's very, this movie has a lot of mixed messages about realism in this.
Well, that's always been my burning question is like, would this scam actually work?
Well, because then, as the movie does show you, something happens along the process of putting on a show that all of a sudden it's camp and people find it hilarious and they love it because you are making a statement of some kind. So it's good that it bites them in the ass, because then I guess it prevents people from being like, let's be producers and put on a bad show and make them a lot of money. Because you are going to lose a lot of money, because then you have to like pay a shit ton of people, which they don't talk about. Like, producers want their money back, or like the backers want the people funding it want their money back, because it's basically a loan. Yeah, you're investing in something, and like you want to get something out of it. What else do we got? Oh, so I had a question about the casting of Will Ferrell because it felt like they cast him because of his character in Austin Powers.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate.
I think he can just do, he has fun with a German accent. Like,
he's living his best life in this movie.
But this one, like this movie, he just takes it to the extreme. Like, he seems like he had a blast. Like, he always does on whatever he's doing. But this one, I think he was just like, I'm just going to go all out. Like,
I wrote that when he announces he broke his other leg. And I was like, oh, this is like your character in Austin Powers, where you're off screen shouting, like, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I said Uma's having a blast. You guys said that Will's having a blast. I think everyone is just having a blast with this movie. And I hope that is true. Like, I know that, I feel like Nathan Lane is probably losing his voice because he's shouting everything.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like
he must have done some serious damage to his vocal cords.
Like, specifically, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, like, they were just told, like, you have free range, do whatever you want, and they give just the most unhinged performance. Like, these are crazy people, like, and it really, it just helps the movie.
But it works for this movie, though. Like, if they were to do this with other things, I don't think it would be treated the same way. Like, this movie tells you right off the bat that there are no rules here.
Yeah.
Cause like, I realized that when we got into I Want to Be a Producer, when Leo Bloom imagines this kick line of, like, you know, rockettes or dancers and everything, but then they come back into the quote unquote real world. So it was like, okay, there are no rules. That's fine. Let's go. Let's go, everyone.
Everyone can do whatever they want in this movie. And you're just like, oh, this is all believable in the realm of, like, this story.
Yeah. And then you follow that up with Der Guten Tag, Hop Klop, and then Keep It Gay. And those two back to back you're like, this is pure insanity.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, they're really, everyone in this movie is like committing like 100%. And I don't think you see that in like every movie, but this one just seems like everyone involved is like, we're going to a 10.
Yeah. Yeah. You wanted me? Fine. You got all of me. You got everything.
You're cheating everything. And that's why I'm so surprised that this movie, like, because I think this movie flopped. Like, no one besides Matan I know has seen this movie or, like, cared about it at all. And I don't understand how this didn't appeal to everyone.
On Rotten Tomatoes, I'm like, why? Like, this holds up, like, unless...
I think it's a, like, 9 out of 10 movie.
Unless they're, like... holding it up to the original film, which is like, I like, you can and you can't do, but it's like, it's supposed to be its own thing.
Yeah.
This one is actually a musical. Like, I feel like it should be reconsidered the score. Again, this feels like a modern movie. This feels like it could have been released now.
And which is weird because it's 20 years old material. Like, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. It feels like an extended SNL sketch. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, oh, we should, like, you know, let's make a big flop on Broadway. And like, but then they just make a whole movie out of it. But like, Springtime for Hitler, like, it seems absolutely ridiculous. But like, it works because it's so over the top. The whole movie is like a cartoon and people are treated as such, the characters act as such, and it makes this movie feel timeless, kind of thing. And so, like, yeah, I understand why this is such a rewatchable for Sam. And like, I'm not gonna be upset if they redo it, just because, like, almost like True Detective, it's like you want to see who they're going to pair up next.
Yes.
To just...
Margot Robbie. She would be great. She would be great.
I could see her.
But just seeing, like, who they give it to and then what those people do with it and give an unhinged performance. Like...
Billy Eichner as Bialystok.
Yeah, that'd be pretty wild.
I'd almost want him to be Bloom instead.
I think when he plays the straight man, but during the freak out, the blue blank out, it would, like, he would sell it way better than like a Broadway ever could.
Because I think what the idea is behind the duo is to follow the original movie, because Zero Mostel was Bialystok and he's a big dude. So, and it kind of also goes with like Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello, where you have like a bigger dude and a tall, lanky dude.
Yeah. I'm going to say something and you guys can let me know if this has already happened, because it seems like something that's already happened. Josh Gad.
I was just thinking Josh Gad as I was thinking Josh Gad as a Carmen Gia or Roger.
No.
I think he would be great.
I feel like Carmen and Roger, you need more like, who would be a good one?
Stanley Tucci.
Yes. Well,
yeah, that'd be good.
Thanks. Yeah, or somebody along those lines of the Tucci, where you're like, are you gay?
Let the Tucci loose.
That's a quote.
Yeah.
To go back for a second, Sam, you are correct. This movie is a flop. The budget was estimated at $45 million and it made just a little over $38 million worldwide. So,
yeah, I don't get it.
Well, with the $4 I paid to rent it today, we are almost there.
We're slowly
getting there. You're going to put out this podcast. Right. It's going to get a huge surge.
Oh my God. I feel like it did better on like TV or something, because like you can turn it on, watch it. It has a life after the theaters. It's just that it flopped in the theaters because a lot of people don't like musicals, as we've learned over the years.
There's I mean, some of the most classic movies of all time, huge flops. Yeah. I mean, Zoolander.
The first Annie movie, I think, was a flop.
Sure.
Yes, it was.
But it's stuff that, yeah, gets revived on DVD and stuff. And, yeah, TV for sure.
I remember, this is, I think, the only movie that ever flopped that I was disappointed by, solely because I think I was like 14, but I was just like, oh, they're making a movie of the producers. Maybe then Nathan Lane will be able to, like, maybe he'll star in more movies. And then it flopped, and then it took him a long time until his movie career kind of really picked up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't think of it. And
he's had a renaissance the last, what, 4 or 5 years.
And would it be the same with Matthew Broderick as well?
Yeah, like, he struck too.
He had a string of flops. The other thing I like about this movie that we're talking about, the producers, everyone, sorry to go off on tangents, is that they honored, like, so in the stage show, a lot, there's some humor that they have for, like, the audience there, where it's like, for example, when Ula repaints the office, they ask her when she did it in the show. She says, intermission. Like, they do things like that. But, like, in this movie, they still had that type of humor, but they're like, but this is a film, so we can't be like, oh, why, like, for example, like, why are you so far stage right instead of why'd Bloom go far camera right? Like, it's perfect. I just had fun rewatching this. Like, I don't know. It's a thing that I have, though, with comedies these days, when you're revisiting and you're like, okay, is this actually funny? Is this, or is it nostalgia kicking in where it was funny back then, but now we're having a different conversation globally. And like I said, I think this one is going to uphold in the future until it's until it's remade.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I feel the same way. And I do the same thing where I'm like, okay, is this nostalgia? Is this still good? And then, like, how does this hold up now in the way society views things? And then I feel like Mel Brooks just has kind of proven that, like, he's one of the few people that can kind of do whatever he wants tastefully.
Yeah. Cause even in the songs, I know he had a hand in writing them, but, like, it still feels the same type of humor. It doesn't feel like, you know, it's interesting when you're watching musicals, because, like, somebody will write the book, somebody will write the music, and somebody else will write the lyrics. And sometimes it's a little disjointed. But in this case, Mel Brooks had a hand in everything. So, like, it felt very his voice, his style. There was no disjointed nature. Although, like I said, that face just takes a dip for me, because it's like, it's trying to be, it's a little serious. It's a little old Hollywood feeling. And I just needed, like, you know, a little lady to show up or something, something bizarre to happen.
That, and I just think it's like, you're asking a lot of me to really believe the love between the two of them. Like, there's like the language barrier, and they've known each other for like, what,
a day?
Like, I can't buy into it. Even I have my limits as far as, like, reality goes in movies.
I'm gonna say something maybe a little controversial here, so go with me on this one. I feel like Mel Brooks really did want to make the musical version of this story first, because, like, the original movie, I haven't seen it in a while, but I do remember it being very dry. Like, it's still funny, but, like, I lose my attention and everything. And I think the musical numbers do help, like, play into the comedy, play into the storytelling. So
I agree.
I wish I had time to rewatch it before this recording, but I didn't. Nor the thought of rewatching it. But it felt, yeah, it feels like the music of this, the songs, really do, like, propel the story forward, which is what you want to do with a musical. That's the whole point of musical theater. You know, you You have songs that help tell the story and everything. And the moments that they have songs in this, yeah, there is a few in this movie version. There's a few where you're like, oh, we've gone a little too long. We need a song. But what is here is still very like, oh, I'm awake. Oh, we can keep going and everything.
Yeah. I wish that they yeah, see, agreed, because they need the songs. Like in the first one, they only had the two songs, and of course, one of the songs out of the two they didn't bring over, the love. Do you guys remember Love Power from the original?
No,
unfortunately.
Oh, go on YouTube after this and watch Love Power. He sings about picking a flower and giving it to a cop, and the cop stepping on his flower. It's Dick Shaw, and he's just full of rage and emotion in the song. And I wish they would have brought that over. He played LSD. I forgot that they dropped that character from the musical.
Wait, which one? The
LSD. It was in the original. They hired someone to play. The guy that they hired to play Hitler, his name was LSD. And when he auditioned, he sang this song called Love Power. He was a weird hippie guy. But yeah, they dropped the character for the musical. And I don't know why. I think they should have kept him.
To give Franz more to do, probably.
I mean, it did work out. They could have given Franz the Love Power song somehow, because that was a banger.
Is there anything else y'all want to talk about before we get into Strapping Flat?
I think that covers
all of it.
Yeah.
Great. Let's do it.
Sharp Flat.
So in this section, we're going to highlight some moments, whether or not we talked about it. If we liked it, it's sharp. And if we didn't like it or thought it could change, it's flat. I would like to start with flats, because I didn't have that many flats, but my flats are still very poignant. And we did talk about a lot of them. Well, we did talk about one of them, which my first flat is for Matthew Broderick acting like a cartoon character with his triggers, neuroses, whatever it is that he has. Because they don't say it, and we're only assuming, but he's got something.
Yeah, he's on the spectrum, yeah, for sure.
For sure on the spectrum.
Yeah. Another flat that I have is, okay, go with me on this one. When we first meet Carmen Gia, and he answers the door saying yes, I'm flatting the fact that there's cuts in there, because I would rather just see like a stagnant shot of him holding out that S forever. Cause that is the joke, but like, because there's cuts in it, it makes it feel like, you know, he's not doing it all. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Did I English?
Yeah. But for me, I feel like having the cuts in there make it seem like it's longer than it is in real time, just because there's cuts, if that makes sense. Like, oh, they cut. He's still doing it. They cut again. Oh, he's still good. He's still doing it.
But like the fact that he had to do that on stage as well, eight times a week. So it's like, okay, let's celebrate that moment as if it was on stage and just have the one shot of all three of them in it. And you see Max and Leo react, but you don't need a close up of that. You definitely do not need a close up of Roger Bart holding out an S.
Yeah. I get that.
And then my last flat is for not having a close-up on Brad Oscar. He was the original Franz. He was also nominated for a Tony. Give him a 2-second close-up or something.
They could have made him Mr. Marx instead of John Lovitz, who did do a good job, but like, they could have given him that part.
Yeah. Yes. That's what they could have done.
I saw him in Young Frankenstein, by the way, and he was really good.
Brad?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's so good.
He was really good. I'm really stoked to see that.
Sam, since you're now talking, what are your flats, if you have any?
I only have two more to add than you. I mean, we kind of covered the Tolhem song flat. That, Tol Rio, really any Bloom, Olga combo flat of the movie.
Ula. Yeah, that's for me as well. That was, yeah.
Her name is Ula. Don't say Olga.
That's how much she made an impact.
That's how much she made an impact in my life. Every time I see this movie,
yeah.
I zone out. I'm like, oh, let me check Instagram real fast.
Yeah, continue on.
That's the biggest one. Other than that, it's just Hollywood people for not appreciating this movie more. Because I think this movie is a 9 out of 10.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, so on my flats, again, all the same stuff, same as the you know, same as Sam's. But one thing for me, and this was like a technical thing. So in I Want to Be a Producer, when they have tap dancing in the song, but it's not reflected on the screen, like, I don't know if they were, it was supposed to be them tap dancing. Cause like there's bits where like, it just wasn't synced up with the tap. And it's like, oh, are they not doing a tap song? But there's definitely like tapping in like the track or whatever.
I think they tap in the stage too.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It makes sense that they do that in the stage, but during that performance, it's not lining up, and so it takes me out of it, because I was like, did they just ADR like tap dancing over the song, or like is this the original like Broadway stage recording of like I don't know, because again, like, if you're doing tap in a song, there will be a shot at least that features
the feet,
the tapping, you know what I mean, or like you can tell that they have their tap shoes on, or like it's synced up, but like it would only show like the choreo for like a bit before it like would like pan up for a second. And but like whenever it was showing like the tapping sequences and there was like the tapping in the soundtrack, it did not like sync up at all. And that really took me out of it. So that was a big flat for me.
I had one more flat I forgot about.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I've heard this song so many times that I forget it. They deleted it from the movie, and then I'm always upset. But when they cut out King of Broadway, I don't know why they did that. Great song.
And you said that they recorded it and everything.
Yeah, they recorded it. It's on the like special features, because they just didn't, I think for length, they just didn't include it.
Yeah.
But I'm like, include the better song. Delete the whole Leo subplot, like no one cares.
But they, you have to, just because you don't care about it,
I don't think anyone cares.
But you still
story all that much. I promise you, no one in the world is like, I want to hear these songs and I care about these two characters versus this really good opening number from Nathan Lane. No one is gonna be like, I want those songs.
You never know. There might be some former Maxes that are like, why isn't this in the movie? I loved singing it every night.
See?
Okay, let's get into sharps. So my first sharp is for Susan Stroman's choreography. It's amazing. I love a good dance show. And this one incorporated tap, and I love tapping. My next sharp is for the ushers in opening night. They were so funny. Especially when, like, you know, they got ran over, or they're hopeful and people are like, this show sucks. And they like those ladies did a great job. Sharp to the pigeons, as well as a sharp to Carmen Gia. And then I, for whatever reason, in the trade, I just sharped Nathan Lane in the mama costume. I don't know why. Also, sharp to Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Like, their chemistry was fantastic in this. And then I want to give sharps to the following performances: Keep It Gay and Springtime for Hitler. Those are the ones that I seek out on YouTube to watch every once in a while. Yeah, that's it for me. Sam, what are your sharps?
I'm gonna sharp the entire cast. Like, they all did really well. Like, even Will Ferrell, I'm sure there's a lot of people who doubted him doing it, but I think he delivered. So, but all around, the whole cast just killed it. And then Mel Brooks, you know, being fearless and just writing really catchy songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Just, I guess, the throwaway jokes. Like, another, like, I mean, I already said the don't be stupid, be a smarty.
Yeah.
Come and join the Nazi party. But another thing that's burned in my brain is when they're doing the interview and they're sitting on the couch and Nathan Lane goes, even though we're sitting down, we're giving you a standing ovation. That's another one that lives rent-free in my head.
Sure, sure.
But, yeah.
All right, Matan, yeah. What about you? What are your sharps?
Sharps for me would be, it's a double-edged sword, but, like, Matthew Broderick, all of everything minus any scene with the blanket, like, the freakouts were fine, like, having the blanket. His performance I thought was great because, like, again, like, I'm used to seeing him being, like, really mild-mannered, really quiet and stuff like that. But this was, he was almost as loud and bombastic as Nathan Lane. And then Nathan Lane, just one of the best performances of his of all time, for sure. And just was, he had so many just like both visual gags and like, yeah, like just quick lines and stuff like that. Like I loved his whole cabinet of all of his backers, his old women, and stuff. And like, what was it? Like touch me, kiss me. And like all like,
lick me, so bite stupid. Me.
Yeah. 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 Like, so stupid, but I loved it. And everything he was in flawless, like the whole performance, like there's no slow parts for him. Everything was top notch. And then another sharp was, what's it called? I really like Unhappy. I guess part of it's like the choreo and stuff like that with like the, it's not a typewriter. I don't know what those accounting machines are called, but like
calculators.
Is that old, just like an old school calculator?
Yeah. Period calculator. Yeah.
Oh, crazy. But that was fun. John Lovitz. He's in it so little. But
him, but he packs a punch with it.
He does.
I was gonna say, he rocks that suit in such a way that I want to see him in a movie now where he like in like almost like maybe like a mob movie or something like that, something where he's definitely serious and like almost like an Uncut Gems level performance for him.
Okay.
Where it's like, this is his John Lovitz's like
this is his Uncut Gems.
Yeah, I want that for him. Just from that sequence alone, I thought that was really good. I'm like, this would have been fun to see more of. Definitely the pigeons.
Pigeons.
Just
pigeons are so like, funny.
It is the sewer boys of this musical.
Yes. You can't have Dick's the musical without the producers.
Yeah, like, yeah. There was a lot of stuff in Dick's musical that like having watched this, I'm like, okay, I see there's some stuff that carried over. Yeah. So it was delightful. It was just it was a fun film. And like historically on this podcast, like I'm not a huge fan of musicals or the movies of the musicals that we've done, but this was a highlight because like the movie is great. I've never seen the show, but I'd like to see the show.
So would I.
But like the original was really good. And then this it's just a lot of fun and just like it holds up, but not only that, it feels like it's modern. It's still funny. Like, and I feel like what you were talking about earlier with like the gay stuff or whatever, again, similar to Sam, like not a queer person, so it didn't necessarily affect me, but like it doesn't, I don't think
it's offensive.
The word offensive and things to be offended by is so skewed for me just because like
it's like subjective.
Well, just the envelope has been pushed by everybody in so many ways and just so much is happening.
I feel like
we're desensitized. I feel like
if you don't know Mel Brooks, you could possibly be offended.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
I think if you know Mel Brooks, you know it's not offensive. Like if it was like, I don't know, Mel Gibson who wrote the song, you'd be like, yeah,
yes.
This is bad. It's all about who writes the song, I guess, is what it comes down to.
Mel Gibson, not a songwriter. So,
well, so anyway. and like Mel Brooks, like I said, does tote the line, but he handles everything with care. It feels like a lot of his jokes, there's a lot of there's a lot of slapstick. There's a lot of, you know, wit. There's a lot of wordplay. Like, I'm thinking of in this movie, when in both Der Guten Tag, Hop Klop, and Keep It Gay, like, Matthew Broderick is the butt of some jokes there, especially with, like, being slapped around by Will Ferrell, yeah, and then in Keep It Gay, getting hit on by everyone. Yeah. Yes, it's a little toting the line of, like, people's comfort, but, like you said, you gotta know, you just gotta know what you're in what for.
Yeah. I think it's, I know he did this with Blazing Saddles, but I think it applies across his work, is when he does those, like, maybe controversial kind of jokes. You know, when he does it, he's really just making fun of the bigots, like the racist, anti-Semite, anti-LGBTQ homophobes. Like, he's making fun of them when he does it. And I think it does come across to most people that that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
And like,
there's no maliciousness at all.
No, no. It's just all fun. It's all comedy.
It's all comedy.
Any other sharps? Any other flats, everyone?
I do want to bring up one thing, because we kept talking about how it's timeless. Do you guys remember the Jimmy Kimmel bit from maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
No. What are you referencing?
Okay, well, it's going to get dark for a second. But, like, right after Trump became president, I know, dark times, dark times. He did a bit with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane as Bloom, Leo and as Black Bialystok and Bloom. And they got out of being Broadway producers and were political advisors. And their plan was to put all their money and energy in Donald Trump, thinking he'd fail. And then he won. So it was a play on. It's really funny.
Oh my God. I didn't.
It's really. It's on YouTube.
I have to. I'll have to watch it.
It's really funny.
It's hilarious.
A lot funnier now that Trump is no longer the president.
Well,
for now. In 8 months, the joke might not be as funny anymore.
Would you add any of the songs to your life's playlist?
Almost the entire soundtrack, minus the two. I love them all.
Yeah. I mean, I would even put on that face if I'm just wanting to, like, listen through.
Yeah.
So I wrote the whole album. I mean, there's... I do have my go-tos, but I feel like rewatching this revitalized my, like, love and appreciation for this musical. So I'm just gonna say the whole album and cop out that way.
Yeah.
What about Matan? Would you add
anything? Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Because again, just the whole movie is great. Yeah, minus one or two songs, but it's just like, yeah, when you come to those, you can just skip it, but still, you might as well just listen to the whole album anyway.
Right. Or you listen to it as much as you can. You're like, I gotta go next. I gotta get to the next one.
Sure. Yeah. You're like, oh, this one's all right, but, you know, this one coming up, like, you know, springtime for Hitler. I gotta crank this one up.
Got windows down for springtime for Hitler.
Sure.
Oh, of course. And on that note, gentlemen, we're done with the episode. We did it. We did the producers. Woohoo!
Yay!
What do you have to plug or promote?
Well, we are on a bit of a hiatus at the moment.
After 5 years, we're taking a break.
Yeah.
Good.
A lot of moving parts on our end, but we'll get back into it, get everything back up and going.
I mean, we still have over like 110 something episodes for people to listen to.
Oh, yeah. And then, yeah, but definitely more to come. So Lost in Blockbuster.
At Instagram, TikTok.
Yeah.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts.
Check out the back catalog of everything.
I write for Substack now.
Sam blogs about his experiences in this.
You have a blog now?
I guess I do. Have you been on Substack?
I don't know really what it is.
It's like some place where you can write stuff and
live journal. It's like
some news places have like accounts you can follow. I don't know. I'm just kind of playing with it.
Send me the link so I can put it in the show notes when this episode comes out.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll send it to you. My goal is to do one a week for at least a year. So I have four right now, but it's just like random takes about life, I guess. Like I wrote about gambling. I posted one today about like shit talking, like how it's cool to shit talk the dead and you shouldn't feel bad for it.
You should do one on podcasting. If that's not your first entry, just be like, I'm a podcaster, and this is my thoughts on it.
Yeah,
you should do a podcast.
I should do a podcast. I think you can do a podcast on Substack. Maybe I should do that. Like, just record.
Well, no, don't audio. not to do. Oh, well, yeah, I guess if you want to do like a text to speech kind of a thing, that'd be fun. Or speech to text.
I do that to kind of hear it out, just be like, does this make sense? Or like reading out loud. And it's cringy having the text to speak, but I think it'd be cool if I just read them out as a podcast, maybe. Cause yeah, they would probably only be like 5 minute things.
Yeah, probably.
There you go. Matan, do you have any side adventures you want to plug or promote?
Not at all. I'm just fixing up my plate. It's been a lot of like adult stuff on my end, just trying to taxes and get my place fixed up. And
adulting is hard, everyone.
Yeah, that's been
a struggle.
Yeah, that's been why the podcast has been on hiatus. So,
and that's okay. And that's okay.
We're gonna bring it back soon.
Yeah,
yeah, because we gotta do High School Musical. Come on, I'm waiting.
Yes, obviously.
Yes,
DCOMs. And if you were in a production of The Producers, I'd love to hear about it. You tell me some fun stories and flubs that happened during it. You can email me at buttersongpod@gmail.com. Us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at buttersongpod. Did you like this movie? Like, how did you feel about this movie, dear listener? You heard four of us talk about it, but how did you feel about it? And if you want to be part of the next episode's conversation, well, we're doing a DCOM, and we're going to be talking about Camp Rock.
Huh. Yikes. That is above my time. I'm familiar with it.
I do recall it.
Demi Lovato and the Jonas Brothers back together are getting together for a DCOM.
Yeah.
They got the same chemistry as Bialystok and Bloom.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness, everyone. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming back on the podcast. Can't wait to be on yours whenever that happens.
It will happen, we promise.
Yeah. We're holding it to it. We put it in existence. It's now recorded as evidence.
Yeah.
Yes. And everyone, thank you for listening, and bye for now.
Bye.
Special thanks to Aaron Troy for creating the pod's artwork and to Nick Bombacino for composing the theme song and the jingles. A huge thank you to CastBox for hosting this podcast. And thank you again for tuning in to today's episode of Life's But a Song. Bye for now, everyone, and have a musical day.